The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. Well, this would have been Stampede Week, Jackie.
I know. Kind of weird to think about the fact that we're not wearing cowboy boots and cowboy hats.
Just when we thought the world couldn't get worse, Stampede was canceled.
Yeah, but there are the drive-through breakfasts.
There are.
Yeah, those sound fun.
Have you been through?
No, I haven't. To be honest, I wasn't a big fan of the ones where you could actually socialize, so I'm not sure about the drive-through breakfast. But I hear the first one was successful and they're having more, which is great. It's good to have some things for people to do to remember the Stampede spirit. That part hopefully hasn't been lost.
Well, the Stampede spirit is not lost, and we'll look forward to next year.
Now, this is our last podcast before we're taking a little break for the next bit in July, and we'll be back later on in the summer. So we got to make this a good one.
We'll make it a good one. Well, why don't we start with oil prices?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't talked about oil price in a while.
What did you tell me before we started here? That oil's up $80?
Yeah, like why aren't people more excited? Exactly. It's up $80.
Because it was minus 40 6 weeks ago or something like that.
So it's $40 today. And, you know, you think people would be excited, but $40 is, it's kind of like treading water. It's not exactly like a strong price that companies can do well.
Yeah, I mean, the world's oil industry has a whole spectrum of break-even costs, and $40 is nothing to write home about. I mean, many companies are just not viable or, you know, at $40, I would say on average, it's as you just said, it's a break-even cost, cash flow break-even. There's just not a lot of extra money to certainly drill for new prospects or much else.
But you were drowning before, so now you're treading water, which is a bit better. You're not going to have money for capital spending. And these rig rates in Western Canada are really unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like 9 rigs drilling for gas and 4 rigs drilling for oil. Oil rigs are down like 95% from the same time last year.
13 rigs total. I mean, usually I'm just, what are we? We're July. Okay, summer drilling season. We'd have a couple of hundred rigs by now.
Yeah, in a typical year.
At least, yeah.
And the U.S. is down as well. Okay, so let's talk about what we're going to talk about today. I wanted to talk quickly about this Enbridge Line 5 pipeline because it's been in the news again last week. Then we'll talk about the green stimulus plans. We have talked on the podcast before, our government's going to spend money and put it towards the energy transition or not. So there's some signposts that they may. So we'll talk about what's going on, especially in the EU. And then we wanted to talk about an Energy File commentary that you recently wrote called "Will Oil's Pain Trigger Others' Gain?"
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I think we'll have a spirited debate about that one, about whether or not oil prices are going to go up and what that would mean if they're going to go up another $80.
Yeah. Who knows?
We'll be really bullish.
We're going to have to debate that. But there's definitely some potential scenarios where prices could go high and what would the implications be.
Line 5. Where is Line 5? Let's reacquaint our audience.
Now, we've talked about this before. Line 5 flows under the water between Lake Michigan and Lake Huron in a strait there. And so basically, Line 5 is part of the Enbridge system that takes crude from Western Canada. And instead of going through Canada, it actually goes into the U.S. around Manitoba. And then the pipeline goes through the Great Lakes and back into Sarnia, where it delivers crude oil to Sarnia. And also, obviously, the Enbridge system delivers crude south to the Midwest and other parts of the U.S.
The big refineries in the Midwest, and then some of it also goes down south all the way to Texas.
That's right. Now they've put extensions. Now, this crude oil that goes through the Enbridge system, and Line 5 is an important conduit, can also make it through Line 9 out to Quebec. So it's a very important pipeline for Canada. Now, it's been in operation since the 1950s. And in 2018, there was a boat anchor that struck the pipeline. So remember, this pipeline is going through the Straits of Mackinac, which is basically between Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. It goes right under the lake. And so a boat anchor hit it, and then there was concern about that could damage, you know, it did damage it, but it didn't rupture it. And since then, there's been an ongoing debate about this pipeline, and, you know, it's been decided that they're going to eventually put a tunnel to protect the pipeline, but that's not in place right now.
They're trying to get approval for that, aren't they?
Well, yes. So the original governor approved it, but an incoming governor didn't like the tunnel, but they are going to go ahead with the tunnel. But the issue right now is it looks like there's been more damage to the one of the anchors that holds the pipe. And so Enbridge alerted everyone to that. They shut down one leg. There's kind of a twin pipeline system here where there's a west and east leg. So they shut down one side. Then last week, the court said, no, you have to shut down both sides. But then later on in the week, they said, okay, you can run the one side. But anyway, if you run the one side, that still has consequences because you're still not getting full capacity.
So what is the full capacity?
It's about 540,000
barrels a day. I mean, that's huge.
But I will say there is another pipeline that goes to Sarnia called Line 78, which runs about 570,000. Now, right now, most of Line 78 delivers to refineries in Detroit and Toledo, but it also reaches Sarnia. So if... Well, we already know the pipeline is running less than its full capacity. They will pro-ration everybody. And so that the refiners in the U.S. will also be fairly impacted by this because they will get less crude to make a little bit more space on the other line to get more crude oil.
So we can imagine that the American refiners are lobbying hard in the background to try and remedy the situation.
Right now, I'm not sure there's a lot of lobbying because of the situation we're in. It's a very unique situation in that refineries in the Midwest and in Eastern Canada are running quite a bit less crude oil than they typically do.
Because of the pandemic?
Yes, because of the pandemic. Now, utilizations have come up, but they're still significantly lower than what they typically are. There's a lot of surplus refined products.
In storage.
In storage and things like that. And so because of that, I don't know that this would have such a big implication if it was just a temporary shut-in. If this happened over a long time period, it would probably have more severe implications.
Yeah. I think it's important, though, behind the scenes to think that a jugular vein of energy has been cut off. And so, okay, on one side of the border is the United States and the refiners that we just talked about. But the other side of the border, because it comes back in, as you said, and serves much of central Canada. Like, we've talked about this not only in past writings, but past podcasts, that this is a serious energy security concern.
Yeah, it is. When you think about that, central Canada is relying on a pipeline built in the 1950s that goes under this lake, and that's your only source of crude oil supply. It does seem like we kind of have a one point of failure here.
It's absurd that we're so reliant on this one jugular vein plus this Line 78, which wouldn't be enough. Under normal levels of storage.
No, because you'd have to share it with the American side.
Yeah, and I think it just highlights, again, how vulnerable we are, but also how seemingly blasé we are. I mean, it just barely made the news, frankly. But we're all talking about energy transition and moving off oil and all that kind of stuff. You know, we've talked many times on the podcast, you know, that'll take decades to do. The here and now reality is, if that thing is, for whatever reason, closed off for any length of time and the demand starts to come back, I mean, there's a serious issue.
When we talked about this about a year ago, when the refineries were moving full out, there wasn't any spare capacity in the system, it would have had some significant implications right away. And really, I think the only alternative for Eastern Canada would just be to start getting crude by rail. And Suncor at the time talked about that would be an alternative they would have to look into.
Isn't it?
The good news is we actually have, you know, some rail capacity now to actually make that happen. But yeah, that really would be the option here. In the short term, there's really not much else you could do.
Well, we have the other situation, which is also equally absurd, and we've talked about it many times, which is Cenovus and the first shipment of oil from Burnaby and the Trans Mountain Pipeline all the way through the Panama Canal, through the Caribbean, up the east side of Florida and into Canada.
Yeah, that made the news last week.
I saw this long way around, which is a story that I've, as you know, written about. It's in my latest book, The Investor Visit. I mean, it's just the last time we did this was in the 1970s, and it almost seems like we're having to do it again. It's like, don't we ever learn?
Yeah, although it seems kind of a curious time for me to do that movement. Like at that time, there was a real shortage of crude oil in the world. It was during the oil shocks. Today, we have the world's awash with crude oil.
Sure. And
the economics of moving crude, you know, that way just can't compete with buying crude off the Atlantic Ocean was where Irving could. So I'm not sure how the economics work, but it's kind of crazy that that's what it takes to get crude oil from Western Canada across. Now, the other option would be rail. When I actually think rail might be cheaper, I don't know. Maybe not to get as far as Irving.
Cheaper than going through the Panama Canal.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know that. But obviously, they chose the Panama Canal.
Well, I think they're testing supply routes to seek alternatives, which I guess is a good thing. But obviously, a bullet pipeline, Energy East or whatever, makes a heck of a lot more sense if we're at all serious about any sense of energy security, because not only are we now beholden to a foreign state, the United States, and some courts in Michigan, to, you know, we're hostage to them in terms of our energy security and viability. Very few alternatives.
Yeah, and the pipeline situation is getting more hostile all the time. Like, did you see the news today about this North Dakota pipeline? So here's a pipeline that's been operating for several years that the courts just decided the environmental impact statement done years ago wasn't done sufficiently. So they're talking about draining the oil out of the pipeline until they do this environmental work to decide if they should have built the pipeline or not. So this is a world where even the existing pipelines, I don't think, can be taken for granted. And having redundancy in the system is very important.
Is really important to have the redundancy. And you know, I think that's something also that the pandemic taught us about other supply chains, be it medical supply chains, food supply chains. And there's a lot of, I'll call it not nationalization, but I'll say a repatriation of supply chains back into Canada to be able to do that, you know, manufacture masks or medical equipment on our own without having to rely on foreign countries. Don't you think we should be doing that with our energy as well? And, you know, I'm not trying to suggest that it's all oil either. Like, let's get alternatives from all sorts of energy and fortify ourselves from these seemingly remote decisions being made in a courtroom somewhere in Michigan. It just seems absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. And electricity is the same thing, right? We've really built our connections north and south, not across Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're so flush with resources, but we're not interconnected. It's really a concerning situation at a time when we're deglobalizing and every country in the world is becoming much more insular. And I think that when it comes to energy, we have to be thinking similarly.
Well, maybe that'll be part of the conversations as people think about buying local.
I think so. And I think I'll say it again, because I think we've said it on a previous podcast, that is that, you know, climate change and environment as a driver of change is pretty powerful, but a much stronger driver of change and transition historically has been energy's insecurity. And so it's actually interesting to think that energy insecurity may actually drive transitions of various sorts in this country with greater vigor than the climate change thing.
And it's not just about more use of fossil fuels. It could be use of alternatives as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So on. And I guess that leads to the whole idea of green stimulus plan.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. We've had a number of conversations. If the economic slowdown that we're in because of COVID could result in stimulus programs that try to speed up the energy transition. So I wanted to talk about a few programs that give us some signposts that maybe that would be the case. So at the end of May, the European Union announced a $826 billion proposal. About 25% of that was earmarked for climate change to both help with the coronavirus economic recovery, but also accelerate the move to cleaner types of energy. And there's lots of different things like incentives for rooftop solar, things about the circular economy, which we haven't talked about on the podcast. I think we should talk about that in the future. That basically is just increasing the amount of recycling that we have and a lot less waste. Clean hydrogen, EV charging stations was a big one. Germany's putting quite a bit of subsidies into both subsidies for purchasing the EVs, but also the charging stations. And one I know you'd like, Peter, cycling infrastructure.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Good.
Now, that isn't actually approved. That's a proposal. So all of the states of the European Union still need to approve it. So who knows what it's going to look like when it's done?
These proposals follow on from what we witnessed 10 years ago post the financial crisis, where governments around the world said, boy, oh boy, we got to put people back to work. We got to get some liquidity back into the economy in terms of commerce. What are we going to do? Oh, we've got an issue with climate change and the need to stimulate more renewable energy. At that time, wind and solar were not that economical 10 years ago. And so hundreds of billions of dollars in stimulus money around the world went into it and drove the learning curve and the cost curves down for wind and solar. And 10 years later, here we are today.
Right.
So now they're trying to play the same trick. We'll see if it works, because today I'm not convinced the governments of the world have as much money available to them as they did 10 years ago, as many, we'll call it, economic levers available. You know, back then, they drove the interest rates down. Well, interest rates are already way down. Mm-hmm. So to create liquidity in the economy. So I don't know. I don't know whether these things will work. As you said, the EU, it's just a proposal, the 800 and some billion. It's not quite there yet. We know the IEA just came out with a report proposing this stuff.
Well, so the IEA has been putting a lot of reports out. It's actually kind of hard to keep up with it all. They've been hard at work. I wanted to highlight two reports. In June, they came out with not really a report, but a message that they wanted to put the idea out there that governments have to think about a sustainable economic recovery. And they basically put out a challenge that the world should invest $1 trillion over the next 3 years to not only create jobs, but put the world on a lower carbon path. So they talked about the fact this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If we're going to do this type of stimulus spending, let's put us on the path that we want to get to in terms of climate change. And then they followed that up with a study last week, which is called the Clean Energy Innovation, and things that they think need to change very quickly for countries to meet these net zero 2050 targets.
It's a report worth reading for sure. A couple of comments. The $1 trillion over 3 years, we'll call that $300 billion a year, just nice round numbers. You layer it on top of the existing run rate spending of about $300 billion a year, so it would double it to $600. Yep. You know, I think that's the absolute minimum you would need to actually see significant results. But 3 years is not long enough, in my opinion. Like, you need more than that, and you need more than the EU to do it if you want to see meaningful change around the world. But nevertheless, you know, it's an interesting proposal.
Yeah, and I think they do say it would need more spending after that. Yeah. It's just to kind of rally people around a number. But the new Clean Energy Innovation paper, I think the most interesting insight that came out of it is that policymakers need to recognize that if you don't put the money in today to some of these technologies that are early stage that could get us to net zero, they're not actually going to be available in 2050 because of the time it takes. They talk about the fact there's all these four stages of development. So basically, you start out, you know, in a lab prototype trying to figure out, can you do this? So for example, could you use hydrogen instead of natural gas for an industrial process? Then you need to demonstrate it at scale. Then you have to have early adoption so that you can get the cost down, because often they tend to be too expensive. Then finally, it's mature. And they talked about LED lights and lithium ion batteries that took 10 to 30 years to get from the prototype to mass market.
Oh, sure. It's like 30. I mean, even, you know, I've got it in my energy file collection, the light bulbs. It took 30 years before the light bulb, between, say, the late 1870s and the early 1900s, to actually take off and be adopted, and it was commercially viable. So
we got like 30 years to 2050.
These are long lead time. Yeah. But, you know, some of these technologies are not starting from scratch. I mean, many of them, I would argue, are only 10 years away. And if you spend that kind of money, you are going to see results. My problem with the whole paper is that it's like many other papers that you and I read, and that is a very technology and innovation heavy in terms of the focus. And in my mind, technology and innovation is actually not as much of a limiting factor as some of the other forces of resistance, which, like social issues, political issues, geopolitical issues, you know, these sorts of things, in my mind, are the ones that are rarely talked about in these sorts of reports in terms of obstacles to getting things going. And technology is merely one of the things that you need to get going.
Yeah, that's true. Or they are saying that governments have to take a role here to accelerate this, but you're right, it's more than just R&D spending. Yeah. They actually do have, if anyone's really keen on this stuff, and I'll put a link to this, a database with 400 net zero technologies that they've rated where they are in that scheme, you know, from prototype to more mature. And you're right, they've also put what percentage of them are in which level. One last thing I want to say, I know this one's a long shot, but last week, the House Democrats in the United States released a 550-page recommendations on the climate crisis. So this has been a long-awaited study that they're going to come out. I can't say I read the whole thing, but I did read some articles, the Coles Notes versions. But they had some pretty aggressive goals, like net zero power sector by 2040, zero emissions for all new cars by 2035, so all electric cars.
So let me get this straight, that if the Democrats win, Joe Biden wins in November, that this is going to be one of their directives? These are going to be their directives?
You know, it would take two things. We'd have to get Joe Biden in, and you'd also have to have the Democrats controlling
the House,
the Senate, and the House. House. Yeah. So it would take quite a big shift here in the in the political landscape today. So, but if it could occur, they have some pretty aggressive goals.
Yeah.
You know, they want to build out EV charging. They want to support carbon capture and nuclear, which is good. You know, they're not just trying to rely on renewables only. So they had some diversity in the technologies that they would want.
I have to say, I mean, 20, 35, 15 years away to put into place a policy where all new vehicles, which called say light duty vehicles, cars, are electric. I think that's a realistic goal, to be honest. I mean, given the way the electric vehicle industry is progressing, and Tesla this week, another milestone, its market capitalization exceeded that of Toyota, the largest car company in the world.
That's crazy.
I think that's crazy, but it's basically—
Yeah, you had a stat. By the way, you had a vignette of the week this week on it, which Toyota sells 10.7 million cars a year. Well, Tesla has not yet reached 400,000 cars, yet the value of the companies is the same.
Yeah. Well, what investors are basically saying is Tesla's got a steep growth curve ahead of it, and Toyota ultimately is stalled out or going to go into demise in terms of its sales profile. That's
got to be one steep growth curve to justify such a difference in valuations. But
it is a steep growth curve, but you know, there's a lot of momentum behind it. And I think other EV companies to watch are Volkswagen coming out with their EVs and so on. So I think that, you know, there's another case where there was some impressive electric vehicles that were introduced even in the 1970s. One of them was the Voltaire. So here's another case. You know, it's like 30, 40 years ago, the technology existed to do this, create a Model 3 type vehicle, but the conditions just weren't right because the economics didn't make sense. The people weren't ready for it. There weren't enough charging stations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Today, the conditions are ripe, and the technology and the acceptance is, and the conditions seem to be driving the adoption. So I'm not going to argue with it, actually. I actually think, and being someone who's driven an electric vehicle for almost 4 years, I think that the outlook is pretty positive.
Well, if you think about some of the stimulus spending, if it does occur, all of these things I've talked about talk about really increasing the charging stations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gets rid of that barrier to people buying them, right?
Yeah.
If there's charging stations everywhere, then you're less concerned.
Although, as someone who's had one for 4 years, I rarely ever use a charging station.
Yeah, but do you ever travel very far?
No, I'm not driving back and forth to 3 hours or 4 hours long.
Maybe that's because there aren't as many charging stations, though. You might, you know, it is a barrier to utilization, I think.
I'm just not a road warrior. But honestly, I mean, you just get into the habit, like your phone or anything else, you just plug it in at night and away you go, and you never have to recharge it.
Never have to visit the gas station at 11 o'clock at night when you really want to go home.
I've recharged it in Banff and places like that. But I don't think personally that that's the barrier right now. I think the barrier is that you just got to bring the cost down just a little bit more. And it's very close. It's very close to being dolphin. Now, and I want to say to our listeners that I'm also of the view that it's going to be a long time before 1 billion plus combustion engines are going to be off the road. We've done a lot of talking about that. We've done a lot of modeling. So it's not like the demand for gasoline is going away anytime soon. But if you want to understand why it is that Tesla is valued as much as Toyota, there it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you think about this U.S. House Democrats paper, if you want to have 100% electric cars in 2035, you could, by 2050, have your whole light-duty fleet pretty much electric.
It could be. Let's be clear. 2035,
all new
which
cars.
Is, it's not only the U.S., France, and other countries.
True.
All new car sales have to be electric.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that 15 years from now, I think that's completely possible.
Yeah, when a lot of countries have 2040 goals already. We'll see if they deliver on them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's quickly talk about the last topic, which is the write-up that you did through the Energy File. And you basically have a theory that oil prices could get quite a bit higher, and that may actually help electric cars. And the timing may be several years off, which is when maybe electric cars will be at a point where they're more mature, the costs are down, and that will be the timing that would help electric cars really take off because all the pieces would be in place.
Well, the first half of the thesis and the story is one that is being, I think, more and more acknowledged by oil pundits, subject to debate, that the combination of the pandemic and the low oil prices and the lack of access to capital and the lack of drilling is going to ultimately drive a supply shortfall in oil sometime in the next 12 to 24 months. and that you will see much higher oil prices. There are analysts out there that are saying even $80 mm-hmm. for a barrel yep. and more, right?
Yeah. Well, and they're looking at just how the spending is falling and said, yeah, sure, demand has fallen off, but the supply
is falling
looks
faster.
Like it's going to fall a lot faster, especially if yeah. you kind of go out a few years.
It's a self-referring thing. And as I think we've said in past podcasts, it's a rare time, in fact, I can't remember any time, where oil companies have not been able to access equity capital, debt capital, and have low cash flow. And those three things combined mean capital starvation, which lead to declines in production, which leads to higher prices. Okay, so that's where sort of the first chapter one ends, if you buy into that theory.
Yeah, and there are some other
arguments.
You're
a little bit more cautious, I know, on that one. And I can see your point of view. Like, you think that the glut is going to last potentially longer?
Well, you know, I just think that over the 2015-16 period, there was a lot of innovation. So the break-even costs for developing new oil and gas projects went from like $80 is the price you yeah. would need to justify making an investment to $50. And could there be more innovation over the next several years? Because I do think there is, I don't know about the timing, if it's 12 mm-hmm. to 24 months or 3 years, whatever it is that the market gets tight, there's quite a bit of time there for more innovation to drive costs down. And also, if demand comes back, but some demand is lost, like aviation, it can really extend the time period needed before the market gets tight. So I think there's things that could keep it low. OPEC has significant spare capacity too, especially if we get a return of Libya or Iran or Venezuela starts to increase their supply. Mm-hmm. So there's all those other wild cards. So there's a scenario out there for sure where you could get the higher prices, but there are things, events that could unfold.
I certainly buy into the thesis that costs will continue to come down, but in some ways the cost is irrelevant for the incremental new well if you don't have any money to drill it. And this is the situation we're in today, that the industry is capital starved. And the capital starvation at a time when demand is recovering ultimately leads to supply not being able to keep up. And so the thesis is that that drives higher prices. But that leads into chapter two. Okay, well, what happens when prices go up? Well, we've seen that movie several times before too. People start yelling and screaming. If the price of oil goes high enough and the price of gasoline gets high enough, of course, the policymakers step in. And that's when you start to see stimulus historically onto, okay, now how do we get off oil? This is too hot to handle, is creating all sorts of inflation in the economy. I've got all my constituents phoning me, phones ringing off the hook because the price of gasoline's too high.
Yeah, okay. Causes inflation, which nobody likes.
Yeah.
And we saw that in the 70s, and there were government policies that came out around efficiency mm-hmm. and getting oil out of the power sector. So we've seen that movie before.
Yeah, we did. We saw that in the 1980s with nuclear power coming in. We saw that post the $100 oil era, where we had policies to try and ease dependency. We had, you know, the HOV lanes came in, all sorts of other things, and then stimulus dollars to try and get people off of oil. So,
and the high prices help people choose smaller vehicles too than what we're seeing today.
Yeah, some work that we did, this is back in the pre-2015 when the price of oil was still high, suggested that any price higher than $80 starts to create discomfort in the consumer base and starts to get policymakers fired up. So you get above $80, all of a sudden, I think you're going to start to see policies that would then be stimulus dollars, not from the perspective of trying to be green, but from the perspective of, okay, we got to find alternatives to this price volatile commodity that is causing the consumer base to get riled up about high gasoline prices and also the energy security issue.
Right. And at the same time, you could have electric cars becoming more mature, having more available, more models. Because today, you know, a real barrier is there aren't really that many models to buy.
No,
you know, if you want a truck or an SUV.
Well, they're
really,
coming.
Coming. Yeah. So that could be several years out where you've got all that going. Now, the issue would be too is then the economics, you're saying the economics aren't quite there, but fuel costs could become an issue. So back, do you remember when we had $100 oil? I have a small car, and I remember it would cost more than like $100 to fill that car. It was terrible. And what does it cost to fill an electric vehicle? Like fill your tank, the equivalent of it.
Here in Alberta, to fill up, quote, the tank, I mean, I don't even think it cost me $5.
Yeah. Right? So at that point, you start to say, oh, well, maybe I should look at an electric car. Capital cost, even if it is a little bit more, the operating costs are so much cheaper, right?
Oh, yeah. They're much, much cheaper.
And you get into a tipping point.
Yeah.
Now, the things that could stop the tipping point, there is still barriers. Like, you can't ramp up manufacturing for EVs, maybe.
No.
There is a time period, an S-curve that we talk about to ramp them up. So there'd be maybe issues with not enough batteries or manufacturing capacity or home charging infrastructure. But then again, if government policy starts thinking about that now, that could actually reduce some of those barriers in that time frame.
Yeah, we don't exactly know how it's going to play out, but it would just say sort of historically, if you start seeing a run-up in oil prices, then you will see a coincident policy and social response to the high gasoline prices that it would cause. And typically, there's this chorus that starts to emerge of the get off oil that I would suggest is louder than the get off oil chorus that is driven by the environmental dimension, right? It's all of which is to say, if you're in the oil business, you should not necessarily be hoping for $100 a barrel. The sweet spot is between $50 and $60, in my opinion, right? That's the sweet spot of efficient viability.
Right, where you don't start to motivate substitutes. And then at the same time, if the stimulus spending may help accelerate that as well.
Right.
Okay, well, there's many directions things could go with the oil price. As we said, we're not sure we're going to the bull scenario and EV technology, but there is, to me, the probability of a scenario of higher oil prices colliding with EVs being more mature has gone up.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see how it plays out. The next, always seems like we say that, you know, the next few months are key. There's just so many unknowns out there that it's amazing. But, you know, we've seen
I'd even see the next year, because I actually think a lot of these stimulus packages are probably, like in the U.S., I think they're post-election, post-November.
Oh, definitely.
Canada, they're probably in the next, not in the next quarter, maybe in the next 2 to 3 quarters, if we have them at all. So
I will stick my neck out and say, I don't think we're going to see a lot of green stimulus packages around the world. Right now, there's just so much uncertainty around the pandemic still and the economic damage it's doing that is the focus. But if we get into a situation where we have tremendous, say, oil price volatility, energy security concerns, that as a catalyst to me is far more powerful for promoting change.
All right.
We shall see how it plays out.
We'll see. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll hope you all enjoy some time off this summer. We're going to take a bit of a break and be back later on in the summer. Even if you're not going too far from home, I think there's some great things to find here in Alberta.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's lots of really cool things, whether you go east, west, south, or north.
And we'll be back later in the summer. So should we finish off the podcast with is it a Yahoo or a Yeehaw?
Yahoo. It's a Yahoo.
Yeah. With a Yahoo. So hope everyone does something to remember Stampede Week this week, other than listen to our podcast.
Absolutely.
And we'll be back here later in the summer.
We wish everyone well.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.